had been. Chapter 29. Absorption. Helene lifted her eyes briefly as the ship rose past the toroid herd on the left. The greens and blues were faded, eaten by the distance. Still, the beasts shone like tiny incandescent rings, specks of life ordered in their minuscule convoy, dwarfed by the immensity of the chromosphere. The herdsmen were already too far away to be seen. The herd passed behind the dark bulk of the filament, out of sight. Helene smiled. If only we still had our maser link, she thought. They could have seen how hard we tried. They would have known that the Solarians didn't kill us, as some will think. They tried to help us. We talked to them. She bent to answer two alarms at once. Dr. Martine wandered aimlessly behind her and the co-pilot. The parapsychologist was rational, but not very coherent. She had only just returned from the opposite end of topside. She walked unevenly and muttered softly under her breath. Martine had enough sense to stay out of their hair, thank Ifni, but she refused to strap herself in. Helene hesitated to ask her to go around to Flipside. In her present condition, the good doctor wouldn't be much help. There was a stench in the air. Helene's Flipside monitors showed only a thick, billowing cloud of smoke. There had been shouting and sounds of a terrible fracas just minutes ago. Twice the intercoms had carried the sound of someone screaming. Just moments ago came a shriek that could have waked the dead. Then, silence. The only emotion she allowed herself was a detached sense of pride. The fact that the fight had lasted so long was a tribute to them, especially to Jacob. Culla's weapons should have finished them off quickly. Of course, it wasn't likely they'd succeeded. She'd have heard something by now. She clamped a lid on her feelings and told herself she was shivering because of the cold. It had dropped to 5 Celsius. The less efficient her reactions got as she tired, the more she waited the cold side of the refrigerator laser's increasingly erratic swing. The hot side would be disaster. She answered a shift in the EM field that threatened to leave a window in the XUV band. It subsided nicely under her delicate control and continued to hold. The reefer laser groaned as it sucked heat in from the chromosphere, then back out and downward as X-rays. They climbed with agonizing slowness. Then an alarm clanged. It wasn't a drift warning. It was the cry of a ship dying. The stink was terrible. Worse, it was freezing. Someone nearby was shivering and coughing at the same time. Dimly, Jacob became aware that it was himself. He came erect in a fit of hacking that set his body trembling. For long moments after he got it under control, he just sat, wondering numbly how he was alive. The smoke had begun to clear slightly near the deck. Shreds and tendrils drifted past him toward the whining air compressors. The fact that he could see at all was amazing. He brought his right hand up to touch his left eye. It was open, blind, but it was whole. He closed the lid and touched it over and over with his 3 fingers. The eye was still there, and the brain behind it, saved by the thick smoke and the depletion of Culla's energy supply. Culla! Jacob swung his head about to scan for the alien. He felt a wave of nausea come on and rode it out as he peered around himself. A slender white hand lay on the floor 2 meters away, exposed by the opening cloud of smoke. The air cleared a little more, and the rest of Culla's body came into view. The ET's face was burned catastrophically. Black crusts of seared foam hung in shreds from the remnants of the huge oculars. A sizzling blue liquid seeped from large cracks in the sides. Kulla was obviously dead. Jacob crawled forward. First he had to check on Larock, then Fagin. Yes, that was the way to do it. Then hurry and get someone down here who can work the computer panel, if there was still a chance to reverse the damage Kulla'd done. He found Larock by following the man's moans. He was several meters past Kulla, sitting up and holding his head. He looked up blearily.
"Ooh, Demwa, is that you? Do not answer. Your voice might blow my poor delicate head away. Are you all right, Larock?"
Larock nodded.
"We are both alive, so Kulla must not be, no? He left his job on us incomplete, so we may merely wish we were dead. Mon Dieu, you look like spaghetti. Do I look like that?"
Whatever the effects of the fight, it had brought back the man's appetite for words.
"Come on, Larock. Help me up. We still have work to do."
Larock started to rise, then wavered. He clutched Jacob's shoulder to keep his balance. Jacob choked back tears of pain. Jerkily, they helped each other up and onto their feet. The firebrands must have burned out, because the chamber was rapidly clearing. Wisps of smoke trailed in the air, though, hanging before their faces as they staggered along the dome in a clockwise direction. Once they encountered the P-laser beam, a thin, straight tracery in their way. Unable to go over or under, they went through. Jacob winced as the beam stitched a bloody line along the outside of his right thigh and the inside of his left. They continued. When they found Fagin, the Kantan was comatose. A faint sound came from the blowhole and the silver chimes tinkled, but there was no answer to their questions. When they tried to move him, they found it impossible. Sharp claws had emerged from Fagin's root pods and dug into the tough, springy material of the deck. There were dozens, and no way to loosen them. Jacob had other business to tend to. Reluctantly, he led Larock around the Kantan. They staggered toward the hatchway in the side of the dome. Jacob gasped for breath next to the intercom.
Helene?
He waited, but no one answered. He could hear, faintly, his own words echoing from topside. So he knew it wasn't the mechanism. What was wrong?
Helene, can you hear me? Kulla's dead. We're pretty badly torn up, though. You or Chen come down? Down and fix.
The cold air blasting from the reefer laser sent him into a fit of shivering. He couldn't talock anymore. With Larock helping, he stumbled up past the duct and collapsed to the sloping floor of the gravity loop. He fell into a fit of coughing, lying on his side to favor his burned back. Slowly the hacking subsided, leaving him raw and aching in his chest. He fought off sleep. Rest, just rest here for a moment, then over and around to topside. Find out what's wrong. His arms and legs sent tremors of sharp pain up to his brain. There were too many, and his mind was too unfocused to cut all the messages off. It felt as though one of his ribs was cracked, probably from the struggle with Kulla. All of this paled beside the throbbing burden of the left side of his head. He felt as if he was carrying a hot coal there. The deck of the gravity loop felt strange. The tight wraparound G-field should have pulled evenly along his body. Instead, it seemed to swell like the surface of the ocean, rippling under his back with tiny wavelets of lightness and weight. Obviously, something was wrong, but it actually felt good, like a lullaby. Sleep would be so nice.
"Jacob, thank God!"
Helene's voice boomed around him, but still it sounded far away. Friendly, definitely warm, but also irrelevant.
"No time to talk.
Come up here quick, darling. The G-fields are going. I'm sending Martine, but...
There was a clattering, and the voice cut off. It would have been nice to see Helene again, he thought dimly. Sleep invaded in force this time. For a while, he thought of nothing. He dreamt of Sisyphus, the man cursed forever to roll a boulder up an endless hill. Jacob thought he had a way to be tricky about it. He had a way to make the hill think it was flat, while still looking like a hill. He'd done it before. But this time the hill was angry. It was covered with ants that climbed up onto his body and bit him, all over, painfully. A wasp was laying its eggs in his eye. What's more, it was cheating. The hill was sticky in places and didn't want to let him go. Elsewhere, it was slippery, and his body was too light to get a grip on its surface. It heaved with sickening unevenness. He didn't remember anything in the rules about crawling, either. But that seemed to be part of it. At least, it helped the traction. The boulder helped, too. He only had to push it a little. Mostly, it crawled on its own. That was nice, but he wished it wouldn't moan so. Boulders shouldn't moan. Especially not in French. It wasn't fair to make him listen to it. He awakened, blearily, inside of a hatchway. Which hatchway, he wasn't sure, but it wasn't very smoky. Outside, beyond the deck, he could see the beginnings of a blackness, a transparency returning to the red haze of the chromosphere. Was that a horizon out there? An edge to the sun? The flat photosphere stretched out on ahead, a feathery carpet of crimson and black flame. In its depths, it crawled with tiny movements, it pulsed, and filaments sewed elongated patterns above brightly waving jets, waving back and forth, on and on. Saul waved before his eye. Millie Martine stood in the doorway, with her fist up near her mouth, and an expression of horror on her face. He wanted to reassure her. Everything was all right. It would be from now on. Mr. Hyde was dead, wasn't he? Jacob remembered seeing him somewhere in the rubble of his castle. His face was burned up, and his eyes were gone, and he gave off a terrible stink. Then something reached up and grabbed him. Down was now towards the hatchway. There was a steep slope in between. He tumbled forward and never remembered crashing to a halt just outside the door. Part 10. A lovely thing to see through the paper window's holes, the galaxy. Kobayashi Issa, 1763 to 1828. Chapter 30. Opacity. Commissioner Abatsoglu.
Then it would be a fair statement to say that all of the library-designed systems failed before the end?
Professor Kepler.
Yes, Commissioner. Every one eventually deteriorated to uselessness. The only mechanisms still working at the last were components designed on Earth by terrestrial personnel. Mechanisms which, I might add, were declared superfluous and unnecessary by Pill Bubba Cub and many others during construction.
You aren't implying that Bubba Cub knew in advance?
No, of course not. In his own way, he was as much a dupe as the rest of us. His opposition was based solely on aesthetics. He didn't want galactic time compression and gravity control systems crammed into a ceramic shell and linked to an archaic cooling system. The reflection fields and the refrigerator laser were based on physical laws known by humans back in the 20th century. Naturally, he objected to our superstitious insistence on building a ship around them, not only because the galactic systems made them redundant, but also because he considered pre-contact Earth science to be a pathetic accumulation of half-truths and mumbo-jumbo.
The mumbo-jumbo worked when the new stuff failed, though.
In all fairness, Commissioner, I'd have to say that was a lucky break. The saboteur believed they'd make no difference, so he didn't try to wreck them at first. He was denied an opportunity to correct his error.
Commissioner Montez.
There's one thing I don't understand, Dr. Kepler. I'm sure some of my associates here share my mystification. I understand the Sunship Captain's use of the refrigerator laser to blast out of the chromosphere, but to do so, she had to boost at an acceleration greater than the surface gravity of the sun. Now, they could get away with this as long as the internal gravity fields held, but what happened when they failed? Weren't they immediately subjected to a force that would squash them flat?
Not immediately. Failure came in stages. First, the fine-tuned fields used to maintain the gravity loop tunnel to the instrument hemisphere, flip side, then the automatic turbulence adjustment, and finally, a gradual loss of the major field which compensated internally for the pull of the sun. By the time the latter failed, they had already reached the lower corona. Captain Da Silva was ready when it happened. She knew that to climb straight out after internal compensation failed would be suicide, though she considered doing it anyway to get her records out to us. The alternative was to allow the ship to fall, braking only enough to impose on the occupants about 3 G's or so. Fortunately, there is a way to fall towards a gravity sink and still get away. What Helene did was to try for a hyperbolic escape orbit. Almost all of the laser thrust then went into giving the ship a tangent velocity as it fell back again. In effect, she duplicated the program that had been considered for manned dives decades before contact, a shallow orbit, using lasers for thrust and cooling, and EM fields for protection. Only this dive was unintentional, and it wasn't very shallow.
How close did they go?
Well, you'll recall that they'd fallen twice before in all of the confusion, once when the G-thrust failed, and a second time when the Solarians lost their grip on the ship. Well, during this third fall, they came closer to the photosphere than on any of the previous occasions. They literally skimmed its surface.
But the turbulence, Doctor, without internal gravity or time compression, why wasn't the ship smashed?
We learned a lot of solar physics from this inadvertent dive, sir. At least on this occasion, the chromosphere was far less turbulent than anyone ever expected. That is anyone but a couple of my colleagues, to whom I owe a few abject apologies. But I believe the most significant factor was the piloting of the ship. Helene quite simply did the impossible. The auto recorder is being studied now by the TAASF people. The only thing greater than their delight with the tapes is their chagrin at not being able to give her a medal.
General Wade.
Yes, the condition of the crew was a cause of great distress to the TAASF rescue team. The ship looked like Napoleon's retreat from Moscow. With no one alive to tell what happened, you'll understand our mystification until the tapes were played back.
Commissioner Nyan.
I can imagine. You seldom expect to get a special shipment of snowballs from hell. Can we assume, Doctor, that the ship's commander weighted the heat pump system on the cold side for the obvious reason?
In all honesty, Commissioner, I don't believe we can. I think her reasoning was to keep the interior cold so that all of the records would survive. If the reefer laser system aired too much the other way, they'd have been fried. I believe her sole idea was to protect those tapes. She probably expected to come out of the sun having roughly the consistency of strawberry jam.
I don't think the biological effects of freezing were on her mind. You see, in many ways, Helene was a bit of an innocent. She stayed up to date in her field, but I don't think she knew about the advances in cryosurgery we've made since her day. I think she's going to be very surprised a year from now when she wakes up. The others will probably take it as a routine miracle, except for Mr. Demois, of course. I don't think Mr. Demois would be surprised by anything, or consider his revival miraculous. The man is indestructible. I think by now, wherever his consciousness drifts in its frozen sleep, he knows it.
Chapter 31 Propagation. In the springtime, the whales go north again. Several of the gray humps that broached and spumed in the distance had not been born when he last stood on a shore and watched a California migration pass by. He wondered if any of the gray whales still sang the Ballad of Jacob and the Sphinx. Probably not. It never was a favorite of Gray's anyway. The song was too irreverent, too beluga for their sober temperament. The Grays were complacent snobs, but he loved them anyway. The air boomed with the noise of the breakers crashing into the rocks at his feet. It was wet with seawater and filled his lungs with the paradoxical, satiated, hungry feeling that others got from breathing deep in a bakery shop. There was a serenity that came with the pulse of the ocean, plus an expectation that the tide would always wash up changes. They'd given him a chair at the hospital in Santa Barbara, but Jacob preferred the cane. It gave him less mobility, but the exercise would shorten his convalescence. 3 months after waking up in that antiseptic organ factory had left him desperate to get back on his feet and to experience something that was pleasantly, naturally dirty, such as Helene's way of talking. It defied all logic that a person born at the height of the old bureaucracy would have so uninhibited a mouth as to make a Confederacy citizen blush. But when Helene felt she was among friends, her language became impressive, and her vocabulary astonishing. She said that it came from being raised on a power satellite. Then she smiled and refused to explain any further until he reciprocated with acts she knew he wasn't ready yet to perform, as if she was. 1 month to go before the physicians would take them off of hormone suppressants after the bulk of cell regrowth was completed. Another month before they'd be cleared for anything as rigorous as spaceflight. And yet she insisted on pulling out that dog-eared copy of NASA Sutra, wondering teasingly if he would have the stamina. Well, the doctors said that frustration helps recuperation, sharpens the will to get back to normal, or some such nonsense. If Helene keeps up her teasing much longer, they're all going to be surprised. Jacob didn't believe much in timetables anyway. Ifni, that water looks good. Nice and cold. There has to be a way to make nerves grow faster. Something that helps even better than auto-suggestion. He turned away from the rocks and slowly walked back to the patio of his uncle's long, rambling house. He used the cane liberally, perhaps more than necessary, enjoying the dramatic touch. It made being ill slightly less unpleasant. As usual, Uncle James was flirting with Helene. She encouraged him shamelessly. Serves the old bastard right, he thought, after all the trouble he caused. My boy, Uncle James threw up his hands. We were just about to go after you, truly we were. Jacob smiled lazily. No hurry, Jim. I'm sure our interstellar explorer here had plenty of interesting stories to tell. Did you tell him the one about the black hole, dear? Helene grinned nastily and made a surreptitious gesture.
"Why, Jake, you yourself told me not to, but if you think your uncle would like to hear it..."
Jacob shook his head. He'd handle his uncle himself. Helene could get a little rough. Ms. De Silva was a great pilot, and in the last few weeks she'd been an imaginative co-conspirator as well. But their personal relationship left Jacob dizzy. Her personality was powerful. When she'd learned on awakening that the Calypso had jumped, Helene had signed onto the gang designing the new Vesarius II. The reason she announced brazenly was to have 3 years to subject Jacob Demois to a full course of Pavlovian conditioning. At the end of said time, she would ring a little bell, and he would supposedly decide to become a jumper. Jacob had his reservations, but it was already clear that Helene De Silva had complete control over his salivary glands. Uncle James was more nervous than he'd ever seen him. The usually imperturbable politician seemed decidedly ill at ease. The rakish Irish charm of the Alvarez side of the family was subdued. The gray head nodded nervously. His green eyes seemed unnaturally sad.
"Jacob, my boy, our guests have arrived. They are waiting in the study, and Christiane is looking after them. Now, I hope you are going to be reasonable about this matter. There really was no reason to invite that government fellow. We could have settled this ourselves. Now, as I see it..." Jacob held up his free hand.
"Uncle, please, we've been through this. The matter has to be adjudicated. If you refuse the services of the secrets registration people, I'll just have to call a family council and present the matter to them. You know, Uncle Jeremy, he'll probably opt for publicly announcing the whole thing. It'd make good press, all right, but the Department of Overt Prosecutions would have the case then, and you'd have 5 years with a little thing in your rump going beep, beep, beep." Jacob leaned against Helene's shoulder, more for the contact than for support, and flashed both hands in front of Uncle James's eyes. With each beep, the man's aristocratic face paled a little. Helene started to giggle, then she hiccuped.
"Excuse me," she said demurely.
"Don't be sarcastic," Jacob commented. He pinched her, then reclaimed his cane. The study wasn't as impressive as the one at Alvarez Hall in Caracas, but this house was in California. That made up for a lot. Jacob hoped he and his uncle still spoke after today. Stucco walls and false beams emphasized the Spanish aspect. Display cases containing James's collection of bureaucracy-era samizdat publications stood out prominently among the bookshelves. In the mantel was carved a long motto: "The people, united, shall never be defeated." Fagin fluted a warm greeting. Jacob bowed and went through a long, formal salutation just to please the Canton. Fagin had visited him regularly in the hospital. It had been difficult at first between them, each convinced he was deeply indebted to the other. Finally, they'd agreed to disagree. When the TAASF rescue team had broken into the sunship as it hurtled outward on its laser-assisted hyperbolic orbit, they were amazed by the crumpled, frozen condition of the human crew. They didn't quite know what to make of the smashed body of the Pring on Flipside. But what shocked them most was Fagin, hanging upside down by those small, sharp spikes in his root pods, while the laser still put out its potent thrust. The cold had not ruptured almost a quarter of his cells, as it had the humans, and he appeared to have come through the pounding ride through the photosphere unscathed. In spite of himself, Fagin of the Institute of Progress, the perpetual observer and manipulator, had become, himself, a unique personage. He was probably the only sofunt alive anywhere who could describe what it was like to fly, hanging upside down through the thick, opaque fire of the photosphere. Now he had a story of his own to tell. It must have been painful for the Kantan. Nobody believed a word of his tale until Helene's tapes were replayed. Jacob said hello to Pierre Larocq. The man had regained much of his color since their last meeting, not to mention his appetite. He'd been wolfing down Christiane's hors d'oeuvres. Still confined to his chair, he smiled and nodded silently to Jacob and Helene. Jacob suspected Larocq's mouth was too full to talk. The last guest was a tall, narrow-faced man with blonde hair and light blue eyes. He rose from the couch and offered his hand.
Han Nielsen at your service, Mr. Demois. On the basis of the news reports alone, I am proud to meet you. Of course, secrets registration knows everything the government knows, so I am doubly impressed. I assume, though, that you have called us in to deal with a matter that the government is not to know.
Jacob and Helene sat on the couch across from him, their backs to a window overlooking the ocean. Yes, that's correct, Mr. Nielsen. Actually, there are a couple of matters. We'd like to apply for a seal and for adjudication by the Terrigen's Council. Nielsen frowned.
Surely you must realize that the Council is barely an infant at this point. The delegates appointed by the colonies have not even arrived. The Confederacy civil servants.
Had he been about to say the dirty word bureaucrats?
Don't even like the idea of having a supra-legal secrets registration to enforce honesty above secular law. The Terrigen's is even less popular.
Even though it's been shown that it's the only way to deal with the crisis we've faced since contact?
Helene asked.
Even so. The feds are reconciled to the fact that it will eventually take jurisdiction over interstellar and interspecies affairs, but they don't like it, and they're dragging their feet every step of the way.
But that's just the point, Jacob said. The crisis was bad before this debacle on Mercury, bad enough to force the creation of the Council. But it was still manageable. Sundiver has probably changed that. Nielsen looked grim.
I know.
Do you? Jacob rested his hands on his knees and leaned forward. You've seen Fagan's report on the probable reaction of the Pila to Bubba Cub's exposed peccadilloes on Mercury, and that report was written well before this whole business regarding Kulla came to light.
And the Confederacy knows everything, Nielsen grimaced. Kulla's actions, his weird apologia, the whole capsule.
Well, after all, Jacob sighed, they are the government. They make foreign policy. Besides, Helene had no way of knowing we'd live through that mess down there. She recorded everything.
It never occurred to me, Helene said, until Fagan explained that it might be better if the feds never found out the truth, or that the Terrigen's Council might be better suited to handle this mess.
Better suited, perhaps, but what do you expect us, the Council, to do? It'll take years to build up acceptance and legitimacy. Why should they risk it all by intervening in this situation?
For a moment no one spoke. Then Nielsen shrugged. From his briefcase he pulled a small recording cube, which he activated and placed in the center of the room on the floor.
This conversation is under seal by the secrets registration. Why don't you start, Dr. De Silva?
Helene ticked off points with the fingers of her hand.
One, we know that Bubba Cub perpetrated a crime in the eyes of both the Library Institute and his own race by falsifying a library report and perpetrating a hoax on Sundiver, to wit, that he had communicated with the Solarians and had used his Lathani relic to protect us from their wrath. We think we know Bubba Cub's motives for doing what he did. He was embarrassed by the failure of the library to reference the sun ghosts. He wanted to rub the wolfling race's collective nose in its inferiority as well. By galactic tradition, this situation would resolve itself by both the Pila and the library bribing Earth to keep its mouth shut. The Confederacy would be able to choose its reward with few strings attached, though the human race would have to face enmity from the Pila in the future, simply because their pride had been hurt. They could still increase their efforts to remove provisionary sofunt status from our clients, the chimps and dolphins. There has been talk of placing humanity under some sort of adoptive client status, to guide us through this difficult transition. Have I summed up the situation fairly well so far?
Jacob nodded. Fine, except you left out my own stupidity. On Mercury, I accused Bubba Cub publicly. That little 2-year pledge we signed was never taken seriously, and the feds have waited too long to put an emergency sequester on this case. Probably half of the Spiral Arm knows the story by now. That means we've lost what little leverage we would have had with the Pila by blackmail. They'll hold nothing back in their efforts to get us adopted, and they'll use reparations for Bubba Cub's crime as an excuse to force us to accept all kinds of aid that we don't want. He motioned for Helene to continue.
Point number 2. We now know that the one behind this fiasco was Kulla. Apparently, Kulla never intended that humanity discover Bubba Cub's peccadillo. He had his own blackmail scheme in mind. By encouraging Jeffrey's friendship, he got the chimpanzee to try to liberate him, thus enraging Bubba Cub. Jeffrey's subsequent death left Sundiver in such a state of confusion that Bubba Cub would be encouraged to think that anything he did would be believed. It's possible that Dwayne Kepler's apparent mental deterioration was part of this campaign, induced by Kulla's glare psychosis technique. The most important part of Kulla's plan was the hoax of the anthropomorphic ghosts. That part was magnificently executed. It fooled everybody. With talents like those, it's not hard to see why the Pring think they can take on the Pila in a bid for independence. They're one of the most deceptively potent races I've ever come across, or heard of.
But if the Pila were patrons to the Pring, James objected, and if they uplifted Kulla's ancestors from near animals, why wasn't Bubba Cub aware of the possibility that the ghosts were Kulla's hoax?
If I may be allowed to comment on this, Fagin fluted. The Pring were allowed to select the assistant who would accompany Bubba Cub. My institute has independent information that Kulla was a figure of some importance on one of their terraformed planets in an artistic endeavor that we have until now not been able to witness. We had attributed the Pring secretiveness on this matter to habit patterns inherited from the Pila. Now, however, we might conjecture that it is the Pila themselves who were not to witness the art. In their complacent superiority, the Pila must have cooperated unknowingly by denigrating their clients' endeavors.
And this art form is...
The art form must, logically, be holographic projection. It is possible that the Pring have been experimenting for most of the 100 millennia of their sentience, in secret from their patrons. I am in awe of the dedication it would have taken to keep a secret for so long.
Nielsen whistled lowly.
They must want their release awful bad. But I still don't understand, though I've listened to all of the tapes, why Kulla pulled these pranks with Sundiver. How could the hoax of the anthropomorphic sun ghosts, the death of Jeffrey or trapping Bubba Cub into his error, ever help the Pring?
Helene glanced at Jacob. He nodded. This is still your part, Helene. You figured most of it out. Helene took a deep breath.
You see, Kulla never intended that Bubba Cub be exposed on Mercury. He snared his boss into lying and pulling that stunt with the Lethani relic. But he expected him to be believed, here at least. If his plan had carried through, he would have reported two assertions to the Library Institute. One, that Bubba Cub was a fool and a liar who had been saved from embarrassment by the quick thinking of his assistant. And two, that humans were just a pack of harmless idiots and should be ignored. I'll cover that second point first. On the face of it is obvious that no one out there would believe this crazy story of man-shaped ghosts fluttering around in a star, especially when the library has no mention of them. Imagine how the galaxy would react to a tale about plasma creatures which shake their fists and miraculously avoid having their pictures taken, so there can be no proof they exist. Having heard that, most observers would never bother to examine the evidence we did have, the recordings of toroids and of the real Solarians. The galaxy on the whole looks on terrestrial research with amused contempt. Kulla apparently wanted Sundiver to be laughed out without a hearing.
Across the room, Pierre Larocq blushed. No one said anything about the remarks he'd made on terrestrial research over a year back.
The quick explanation Kulla gave when he tried to kill us all was that he faked the ghosts for our own good. If we looked foolish, we might make less of a splash when we announced life in the sun, a splash that would give humanity more publicity in a time when we should be studying quietly to catch up with everyone else.
Nielsen frowned.
He may have had a point.
Helene shrugged.
It's too late now. Anyway, it seems, as I have said, that Kulla intended to report to the library and to the Soro that humans were harmless idiots, and more importantly, that Bubba Cub had been a party to that idiocy, that he had believed in the ghosts and lied on the basis of that belief.
Helene turned to face Fagin.
Is that a fair summary of what we discussed, Count Fagin?
The Contan whistled softly.
I would think so. Trusting in the seal of the Secrets Registration Organization, I will state confidentially that my institute has received intelligence regarding activities of the Pring and Pila that now makes sense in the light of what we have learned. The Pring apparently are engaged in a campaign to discredit the Pila. Therein lies an opportunity and a danger to humanity. The opportunity is that your confederacy could offer evidence of Kulla's betrayal to the Pila, so that those sophants may show how they have been manipulated. If the Soro then came down against the Pring, Kulla's race would be hard-pressed to find a protector. They might be lowered in status, their colonies eliminated, populations reduced. There might be immediate rewards for humanity in this act, but it would do little to change the long-range enmity of the pill. Their psychology does not work that way. They might suspend their attempts to have humanity adopted. They might be willing to accept restraints on the reparations they will insist on paying for Bubba Cub's crime. But in the long run, it will not win their friendship. Owing humanity a debt will only increase their hatred. In addition, there is the fact that many of the more liberal species on whose protection humanity has so far relied would not appreciate your providing the Pila with a casus belli for another of their jihads. The Timbrimi might withdraw their consulate from Luna. Finally, there is the ethical consideration. It would take long for me to discuss all of the reasons. Some of them you would probably not understand. But the Institute of Progress is anxious that the Pring not be devastated. They are young and impulsive, almost as much so as humanity, but they show great promise. For the entire species to suffer terrible depredations because a few of its members engage in a scheme to end 100 millennia of servitude would be a terrible tragedy. For these reasons, I would recommend that Kulla's crimes be placed under seal. Certainly rumors would soon drift about. But the sorrow will be aloof to rumors bandied about by the likes of men.
Fagin's chimes tinkled softly as a breeze came in the window. Nielsen was staring at the floor.
No wonder Kulla tried to kill himself and everyone else aboard the ship when Jacob figured him out. If the Pila get official testimony on Kulla's actions, the Pring are probably doomed.
What do you think the Confederacy will do? Jacob asked.
Do?
He laughed humorlessly.
Why, they'll offer the evidence to Pila with bended knee, of course. Ifni. It's a chance to keep them from giving us a full sector library branch and 10,000 technicians to staff it. It's a chance to keep them from giving us modern ships that no human engineer could possibly understand and no human crew could operate without advisors. It'd put off indefinitely those damned adoption procedures.
He spread his hands.
And it's pretty clear that the Confederacy won't stick its neck out for the race of a Sophant who killed one of our clients, damn near wrecked our hottest project, and attempted to make humans look like idiots among the peoples of the galaxy. And when you get right down to it, could you blame them?
Jacob's Uncle James cleared his throat to gain their attention.
We can try to put the entire episode under seal, he suggested. I am not without influence in some circles. If I put in a good word...
You can't put in a good word, Jim, Jacob said. You're a participant in this mess in a minor way. If you try to involve yourself, the truth will eventually come out.
What truth is that?
Nielsen asked. Jacob frowned at his uncle, then at Laroque. The Frenchman had imperturbably begun to nibble on more hors d'oeuvres.
These two, Jacob said, are part of a cabal whose aim is to undermine the probation laws. That's the second reason I asked you to come. Something's going to have to be done, and secrets registration is a better first step than going to the police.
At the mention of the police, Laroque stopped nibbling at his tiny sandwich. He looked at it, then put it down.
What kind of cabal? Nielsen asked.
A society consisting of probationers and certain citizen sympathizers dedicated to the secret manufacture of spaceships. Spaceships with probationer crews.
Nielsen sat upright.
What?
Laroque is in charge of their astronaut training program. He's also their chief spy. He tried to measure the calibration settings of a sunship's gravity generator. I have the tapes to prove it.
But why would they want to do such a thing?
Why not? It'd be the most powerful symbolic protest imaginable. If I were a probationer, I'd certainly participate. I'm sympathetic. I don't like the probation laws one bit. But I'm also realistic. As it stands, the probationers have been made into an underclass. Their psychological problems are a stigma that follows them everywhere. They react in a very human way. They gather together to hate the docile and domesticated society around them. They say, "You citizens think I'm violent. Well, then, by damn, I will be." Most of the probationers would never do anything to hurt anybody, whatever their P-tests say. But faced with this stereotype, they become what they're reputed to be.
That may or may not be true, Nielsen said.
But given the situation as it stands, for probationers to get access to space...
Jacob sighed. You're right, of course. It can't be allowed to happen. Not yet. On the other hand, we can't allow the feds to whip up public hysteria over this either. It'd just aggravate matters and put off a later, more severe form of rebellion.
Nielsen looked worried. You aren't going to suggest that the Terrigan's Council get involved in the probation laws, are you? Why, that'd be suicide. The public would never stand for it.
Jacob smiled sadly. That's right, they wouldn't. Even Uncle James would have to recognize that. Today's citizen won't even consider changing the status of probationers. And as things stand, the Terrigan's has no authority.
But what is the domain of the Council?
Currently, it's administration of extrasolar colonies. Eventually, it's to include supervision of all extrasolar affairs. And there's where they can meddle in the probation laws, symbolically at least, without threatening anyone's peace of mind.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, now, I don't suppose you've ever read Aldous Huxley, have you? No? His works were still popular when Helene was brought up, and my cousins and I were required to study some of them in our youth. Damn difficult at times, because of the strange period reference, but worth it for the man's incredible insight and wit. Old Huxley wrote one piece titled Brave New World.
Yes, I've heard of it. Some sort of dystopia, wasn't it?
Of a sort. You should read it. There are some uncanny prophecies. In that novel, he projects a society with some unpalatable aspects, but with, all the same, a self-consistency and its own form of honor, akin to the ethics of a hive, but ethics nonetheless. When man's diversity keeps throwing up individuals who don't fit into the conditioned pattern of the society, what do you suppose Huxley's state does with them?
Nielsen frowned, wondering where this was leading. In a hive-like state? I'd guess that the deviants were eliminated, killed.
Jacob raised a finger.
No, not quite.
The way Huxley presents it, this state has wisdom of sorts. The leaders are aware that they have set up a rigid system that might fall before some unexpected threat. They realize that the deviants represent a control, a reserve to fall back on in times of trouble, when the race would need all of its resources. But at the same time, they can't keep them hanging around, threatening the stability of the culture.
So, what did they do?
They banished the deviants to islands. There they were allowed to pursue their own cultural experiments undisturbed.
Islands, eh?
Nielsen scratched his head.
It is a striking idea. Actually, it's the inverse of what we're already doing with the extraterrestrial reserves, exiling the probies from geographically controllable areas and then allowing ETs in to mingle with the citizens who come and go at will.
An intolerable situation, James muttered. Not only for the probationers, but for the extraterrestrials as well. Why, Count Fagin was just telling me how much he'd like to visit the Louvre, or Agra, or Yosemite.
All shall come in time, friend James Alvarez,
Fagin trilled.
For now, I am grateful for the dispensation which enables me to visit this small part of California, an undeserved and extravagant reward.
I don't know if the islands idea would work that well,
Nielsen said thoughtfully.
Of course it's worth bringing up. We can go into all of the ramifications another time. What I'm having trouble figuring out is what this would have to do with the Terrigan's Council.
Extrapolate, Jacob urged. It just might ameliorate the probationer problem somewhat, to set up some sort of island Coventry in the Pacific,
where they could pursue their own path without the perpetual observation they undergo everywhere today. But it wouldn't be enough. Many probationers feel that they are emasculated from the start. Not only are their parentage rights limited by law, they are also excluded from the most important adventure mankind has ever undertaken, the expansion into space. This little imbroglio Laroque and James were engaged in is a prime example of the problems we'll face, unless a niche is found for them, so that they can feel they're participating.
A niche? Islands? Space? Good Lord, man. You can't be serious. Buy another colony and give it over to probationers?
When we're still in hock up to our ears for the three we've got?
You must be an optimist if you think that could pass.
Jacob felt Helene's hand slide into his own. He barely glanced at her, but the expression on her face was enough. Proud, alert, and just on the edge, as ever, of laughter. He twined his fingers with hers to cover the most area and squeezed back. Yes, he said to Nielsen. I have become somewhat of an optimist lately, and I think it could be done.
But where would we get the credit? And how do you salve the wounded egos of 500 million citizens who want to colonize when you're giving space to non-citizens? Hell, colonization wouldn't work anyway. Even the Visarius II will carry only 10,000. There are almost 100 million probationers.
Oh, not all of them will want to go, especially if they get a place on the islands as well. Besides, I'm sure all they're looking for is fair treatment. A share. Our real problem is that there's not enough colony room or transport. Jacob smiled slowly. But what if we could get the Library Institute to donate the funds for a Class 4 colony, plus a few Orion-type transports specially simplified for human crews?
How do you expect to persuade them to do that? They're obligated to compensate us for Bubba Cub's hoax, but they'll want to do it in a way that serves their purposes, like making us totally dependent on galactic technology. In that, they'd be supported by almost every race. What could make them change the form of their reparations?
Jacob spread his hands. You forget. We now have something they'll want. Something very precious that the Library Institute can't do without. Knowledge. Jacob reached into his pocket and pulled out a slip of paper. This is a ciphered message I received a little while ago from Millie Martine on Mercury. She's still restricted to a chair, but they wanted her back there so badly that they let her travel over a month ago. She says that full dives have been resumed in active regions. She's already been down once, in charge of the effort to reestablish contact with the Solarians. So far, she's been able to avoid telling the Feds much about what she's found, waiting instead to confer with Fagan and myself. Contact has been made. The Solarians talk to her. They are lucid and have a very long memory.
Incredible! Nielsen sighed. But I'm getting the impression you think this will have political implications relating to the problems we've discussed here?
Think about it. The library will believe they can force us to take reparations on their terms. But if it's handled right, we can blackmail them into giving us what we want instead. The fact that the Solarians are talkative and can remember the distant past... Millie hints that they remember dives into the sun by ancient sulfants, so long ago that they might have been the progenitors themselves. Means that we have found a prize of unprecedented proportions. It means that the library must try to find out everything they can about them. It also means that this discovery will get a great deal of publicity. Jacob grinned. It'll be complicated. First, we've got to play to the impression they already have that Sundiver is one big fiasco. Get them to assign us a library investigation patent to the Sun. They'll imagine it will only make us look more idiotic.
When they realize what we have, they'll have to buy it from us at our price. We'll need Fagin's help to finesse it properly, plus all of the savvy of the Alvarez clan and the cooperation of you Terrigan's people. But it can be done. Uncle Jeremy, in particular, will be glad to know that I'm going to dust off my long, dormant skills and get involved in dirty politics for a while, to help. James laughed.
Just wait till your cousins hear. I can see them shuddering already.
Well, tell them not to worry. No, I'll tell them myself when Jeremy calls a family council on this. I'm going to make certain that this whole mess is settled within 3 years. After that, I'm retiring from politics permanently. You see, I'll be going on a long trip about then.
Helene let out a small gasp and pressed her fingernails into his thigh. Her expression was indescribable.
One thing I'm going to insist on, he said to her, wondering if he could or wanted to suppress the urge to laugh or the roaring in his ears. We'll have to find a way to take along at least one dolphin. Her limericks are awfully dirty, but they may buy us supplies in a few ports while we're out there.
The End. You've been listening to Sundiver by David Brin, narrated by George K. Wilson. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Sci-Fi Audio recommends the next book in David Brin's Uplift series, Star Tide Rising, also narrated by George K. Wilson. When Streaker, the first starship designed and crewed by dolphins, discovers a derelict ancient armada with evidence of the first sentient species ever, she sets off a war between dozens of galactic races eager to use the information for their own advancement. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to www.recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.